Well, hello everyone, and welcome to our panel on character, engineering and technology. My name is Ed Brooks and I'm the Executive Director of the Oxford Character Project. If like me, you've been here enjoying Professor Shannon Valla's talk, we're now going to move into a discussion amongst some eminent panelists to further our understanding of this important theme in our conference this afternoon. It's my particular pleasure to introduce the moderator for this afternoon's panel, Dr. Olga Pierakos, founding chair and professor of the Wake Forest University Department of Engineering. A biomedical and mechanical engineer, Dr. Pierakos has mentored over 200 student research and design projects. She's won more than $4 million in external funding and written over 140 peer-reviewed publications. She is currently the principal investigator of a major grant from the Kern Family Foundation to integrate character into engineering education at Wake Forest. So we're delighted that she will lead our panel on character in engineering and technology. Olga, thank you so much. Over to you.
Thank you so much, Ed. I feel so blessed to be here today with you all. Truly blessed. I want to thank Michael Lamb, Kenneth Townshend, Ed Brooks, and all the other visionary conference organizers for making this event a reality and creating space for these essential and needed conversations. I'm grateful for the keynote talk by Shannon Valla, who offered a powerful, truly powerful perspective for the needed moral and technical competencies that engineers and technology professionals must have. Character is not something that one learns just from reading a book or reading a code of ethics. Character is in our conversations, in our actions, and in the decisions we make every day. Engineers and technology professionals unleash the spirit of innovation to improve our lives. But bettering humanity cannot be achieved without character and ethical responsibility. With that, I would like to introduce the panelists with us today. Norman Fortenberry, Deborah Johnson, and Doug Melton. Each of these panelists bring a diverse perspective of engineering and ethical experiences. I have immense respect for each of them as thought leaders who inspire us to do better and be better professionals in engineering and technology. Norman Fortenberry is the executive director of the American Society for Engineering Education. It's a global network for the advancement of engineering education. As an engineer, educator, leader, policymaker, and scholar, Norman advocates for engineering and how we educate the next generation of engineers. Deborah Johnson is the Emeritus Olson Professor of Applied Ethics in the Science, Technology, and Society program within the Department of Engineering and Society at the University of Virginia. As an educator and award-winning scholar, Deborah publishes on issues involving artificial intelligence, big data, and information technologies. Doug Melton is a program director at the Kern Family Foundation and works with the Kern Entrepreneurial Engineering Network, a collaborative network of 50 universities and colleges jointly aimed at building entrepreneurially minded student engineers of character. As an engineer, educator, innovator, Doug advocates for engineers with an entrepreneurial mindset who lead with purpose and character. I'm so blessed to be here with you, panelists. Are you ready to get started?
Absolutely, sounds perfect.
I only have 100 questions for you. That's all. I'm just kidding. It's just 75 of them. The first set of questions are targeted at your personal reflections of character. And with each question, I will ask one of you to start and then proceed with the other two panelists to contribute their unique perspectives. The first question is a why question. And this one's going to Norman, and then Deborah and Doug. Why is character important for those in engineering and technology.
I think our keynote speaker, thank you first for having me as part of this panel. I think it's very important and I'm very pleased and privileged to be part of it. I think large elements of the answer to that question of why were highlighted in the keynote address. Engineers are increasingly central to daily life across the planet. And so the necessity of having engineers of character engaging in the profession because of their effect on human life in all of its aspects, or virtually all of its aspects, is pervasive. And so therefore we need people of character to engage in the engineering profession because that it affects how people live, where they live, the nature of their daily lives. And with that level of impact, to have people who were not of high character would be a disaster.
You want me to jump in here?
Yeah, please.
Yes, please do. Thank you. Thank you, Norman.
Yes, thank you. And I completely agree with that. I think, you know, I agree with that engineers build the world that we live in, and who they are makes a difference in what they do in building the world. But I'd like to draw attention to the fact that engineers work in very complicated context, mostly organizational context, in which they don't necessarily have a lot of power or a lot of say. I'm kind of still reflecting on Shannon's talk. And so I think it's important that they have character, because I think there are kinds of, and particular virtues, of course, but in particular because there are lots of pressures in that environment. And so they need certain virtues in order to do good in that environment.
I'll jump in as well. The keynote was very helpful to point out some of the challenges, really a clarion call for ethics and virtue. You know, there's of course been many additions to this conversation over a long time period. And one that I recall is from William Wolfe, former NAE president, who talked about the difference between microethics and macroethics. And microethics, you know, those daily decisions that an individual makes, versus macroethics, where we're deciding large topics. And engineering kind of has to get together as a profession to think about some of the implications that particular decisions or directions go. I would say that part of this is understanding how to level up from those micro ethics to the macro ethics and actually work together. So to answer your question, absolutely. Some of the answers are obvious around safety, but again, back to Shannon Ballard's keynote presentation, it goes beyond safety in codes these days. With the complexity that we are involved in, it's beyond that. So,
Olga, if I could pick back up, because I want to really resonate with Doug's point about the Bill Wolfe's observation of micro and macro ethics. I was privileged to work with Bill when I was at NAE. And so I think that's a critically important point. I mean, there's the ethics of the individual, so you're not going to steal or fudge your numbers. There's the ethics of the organization, whether that be public or private. You know, is somebody, as was the case with Challenger, somebody going to override a decision where you have offered your best engineering judgment that this is not a safe thing to do? And then there's the ethics of the profession as itself. And there's a challenge that we increasingly see that was referenced in the keynote by Dr. Ballard about, you know, the tension between engineers increasingly as employees versus engineers as standalone professionals, and how do they protect the profession or balance the duty to the employer versus the duty to the profession? And that's increasingly, we're seeing that now students are already asking those questions. They are concerned about, okay, I wanna work in energy, but is there a way to work in cleaning up fossil fuels? Is there a way to develop non-polluting energy? Because I'm concerned about the future of the planet. And so, yes, I am working perhaps in one desk in a large room that's part of another large room that's part of a larger complex. But I have a responsibility as an individual, as a member of this organization, and then as a member of the profession. And so we need to help them negotiate that space.
If I can just pick up on that and carry the conversation.
The conversation, yes.
When I first started working on engineering ethics, this would be back in the 1980s, the big issue, the main issue, because the field was just developing then, was whistleblowing. There were these major cases. The ones I remember are the BART, the engineers, and there have been throughout history, you know, since then. And what I learned about from I kind of kept asking why whistleblowing, why is that the major quote engineering ethics issue? Of course, it's not the only one, but I learned there that there is this tension for engineers. It's at the heart of the profession that engineers, on the one hand, are judged as professionals, as engineers, as individuals, but they're also judged by the organizations that they work for. So they're the demands of business, which usually is meeting deadlines and coming in on budget, and they're right in the middle of that. Usually whistleblowing is, do I act as a professional according to what I've been trained or what I've, you know, commitment to safety, or do I kind of, you know, fudge that and do what my boss tells me? So, I mean, and I was thinking that, you know, what are the virtues you need to balance that, to do that balancing?
And so, to add to that, you know, I think Dr. Valor pointed out practical wisdom as sort of one of those natural virtues that an engineer needs. And this is a little bit nerdy, but when I think about a decision, an engineering decision, it's almost like a free body diagram where there are multiple forces pulling multiple directions, right? And so what you described, Deborah, I think is spot on. And they're not ignoble forces. The goal around being profitable so that you can continue the good work that you do, or the goals around your profession, all of these things kind of are just pulling. And it's that practical wisdom point that I think, how do we elevate that in our profession and raise not only awareness and tools, but really a large human capacity around that, engineering, a professional capacity that elevates that to the forefront of the stage, to say practical wisdom in these complex times is a key virtue. I love the point of the keynote.
Those are beautiful responses. I really appreciate the depth and the exchange you all are having. I think all of you are leading to my next question. And the next question is, what virtues? So you just talked about practical wisdom, but what other virtues or character traits have been most important in your life and in your career? Yes, that's right. I need to designate Deborah. I'm gonna ask you to go first with this one, and then follow that up with Doug and Norman.
It's not an easy one because I'm not an engineer, so I'm torn between, you know, my personal ones and things I've thought about for engineering. So given what I just said about whistleblowing and that tension, I mean, I've thought about saying that the virtue, you know, the most important virtue or one of the most is something called moral courage, which I think Shannon alluded to. And I think there is something about, let me just carry that through, you know, being able to stand up under these pressures. But it's really a little bit different. And so I don't know what term to use in terms of a virtue. It really has more to do with, I think, this capacity to step back and look at the environment in which you're acting and kind of understand how to navigate that territory. Maybe that is practical wisdom, I don't know. And then let me just mention one other, which is, I think, really undervalued in engineering, and that's communication. So this idea that you're working on this one piece of this much larger thing, in order to be effective and effective from a kind of ethical point of view, you need not just to understand all those pieces, but to communicate with the people who are working on those pieces. Even in the case of a potential whistleblowing situation, you need to be able to talk to someone or multiple people about what you're concerned about and communicate your concern. So I would say communication, whatever, how we ever consider that. And there are many aspects of that from the point of view of virtue, and then moral courage.
Thank you, Deborah. You're absolutely right. I mean, we bring our whole self to our professional practice. So even though you're not an engineer, you're bringing all of these important virtues and character traits to the work that we do. Doug, would you like to add to that?
Yeah, I like the fact that Deb picked two, and so I'm going to pick two as well. You know, one of the frameworks, there are many frameworks, of course, around virtue. One of the frameworks categorizes virtue into civic, performance, intellectual, moral. And under the moral category, one element is compassion for others. And we've seen in engineering sort of a virality with this design thinking, which starts with empathy. But the idea of empathy, it's not just for a design purpose. It's not just a tool to get stuff done. It starts with this compassion for others virtue. I was impressed with a previous panel where I think it was a religious panel where the rabbi said that people that go into the religious professions should start with a love for others. And that should be the question they ask themselves. And he said, and it's not a love for studying the text. And I think I misunderstood. I heard him say tech. And so this is maybe a bias on my part. And I thought, okay, engineers, maybe this compassion for others should be the starting point, and care for creating value for others is actually, it's so fundamental to engineering. And yet we can be sometimes blinded by the technology, blinded by the processes and the projects. And so that's one virtue that I think needs elevated, made more visible. The other is arrogance. That is, you know, is that's on the vice side of things, but humility is what Dr. Valor pointed out earlier. And you think about what is the expression for humility? What happens when you're humble? Curiosity often happens. You are become more of a listener than a teller. And so I would advocate for those two, humility and compassion for others are two virtues to elevate.
I'm going to pick up on Doug's point and reiterate humility, both at a personal and a professional level, not only for the listening that Doug spoke to, but, you know, we spend a lot of time because of the nature of engineering preparation. Students assume, for lack of a better term, a Marine Corps mentality, the few, the proud, the engineers. And that can lead to arrogance that Doug referenced in terms of what we think of other professions. And yet for an engineer to be successful, not only must you communicate with other people in other disciplines, other fields, other professions, as Deborah has indicated, but you have to be willing to listen when they communicate to you. Understand that we have to work collaboratively if we are to achieve the engineering objectives, because things don't exist in a vacuum. And so this personal humility and the professional humility, I think, are both critically important. And then that leads to the next point, which is an attention to context. You know, you're not just designing a widget, you're designing a product or a process. You're designing a product or a process or a service that will exist in some context that will be used by people. You know, the best example of that, there was research done several years ago by the Center for Advancement of Engineering Education, University of Washington, where they talked about students designing a playground. And one set of students, mostly male, were concerned with okay, what are the forces on the swing set and the friction on the slide? And another set of students, mostly female, were concerned with, well, where is this playground located? Who will be using it? What are the hours of operation? How close is it to the local school? How close do families get to? And those things, that context is critically important in terms of the anticipated use and therefore the successful design of that system. And so I think attention to context is also important.
Well, and if we could just extend that out, the social being aware or anticipating or considering the social implications.
Absolutely.
Of what, that seems an extension of what you were saying.
Absolutely. Yeah, that context and thinking about, you know, sometimes people are off put by the use of the term stakeholders because it has that businessy kind of flavor to, but there is, I had the opportunity to be an R&D director for a while, and we designed a system that I will say we loved the system we designed a little too much, to the point where we did not get, we probably didn't get that stakeholder feedback that we needed. And it's that, I think it's actually even virtuous to think in terms of, think about the virtues that really benefit that customer, that you can be developed that benefit a customer. And so that's what some of the things I think we're talking about.
What I hear in what you're saying too is that as engineers in the practice of engineering, we bring these values to the table. We bring our own sort of personal traits and strengths to the table as we design. And so being able to be explicit in how we educate the next generation of engineers in pointing out and talking about values and talking about virtues will inform the process that we use for designing, the amount of engagement that we have with our ultimate client or that ultimate user. So I really appreciate that. Does anybody want to contribute more to that conversation? Okay, I'm going to move us, if it's okay, I'm going to move us to the next piece, which is a recognition that becoming more virtuous or developing character does not just happen in a silo. It's something that is ingrained in how we are trained, educated, right, from as young kids. And so my question to you all is, who's one exemplar and role model, maybe in your personal life, but also in your professional world, who has helped shape your understanding and exercise of character? Doug, I'm going to start with you, and then we'll take it off to Norman and then Deborah.
You know, Olga, I appreciate the question. I heard this question in a few other panels, and I was nervous about this question, because it is incredibly hard to answer. And I think I would take the approach that I think it's Joseph Fishkin talks about, we are all sedimentary creatures. And I'm going to butcher this quote, but it's about how layer upon layer, and I think of 3D printing for some reason, layer upon layer, we are built, and the experiences that we have shape our character and the way we interact with them and what we learn. If you were to pick out some individuals, I would have to say my parents, I would have to say my coworkers, my first job. It is a layer upon layer building. There's a collection of essays that come from, I think it's the Brookings Institute, 16 sharp, short essays that talk about character, the opportunity, character and opportunity, I think it's called. And within there, Stuart Butler wrote one of these pieces called Cultures Build Character. And it's sort of an opinion, short essay piece. And I absolutely agree with even the point of the question. It is the culture around us. It's what we immerse ourselves in, the expectations we have of others and the expectations they have of us. And I can think of so many contributors.
Well, let me follow on Doug and reiterate the layers argument. I mean, it's absolutely true. It was a wonderful example. And then maybe throw in a quote from my grandmother that, you know, you can learn something from everyone, if nothing else, what to avoid or what not to do. So, you know, you learn from everyone that you encounter.
Well, I must say I had the same sort of fear as Doug. This was the hardest question for me. So, and I mean, I thought of one of my mentors who, of course, modeled many things for me. But what I, if I can just turn the question a little bit, I mean, this seems to me to be one of the really tough things to my mind about engineering education, in the sense that the models for our students, that is the faculty who they see and tend to model themselves after, or at least learn from by watching, have not had this or embraced this responsibility for the social implications of what they do. I mean, the culture of engineering has traditionally been, we divide tasks up, and the engineer's task is to design this technology, and then society is supposed to decide whether to use it or not, and sort of not see themselves as having. So, and that's really embedded in the culture of engineering education. And so that, in terms of models or exemplars, that worries me.
So I want to interject and pick up on that, because I think that's a critically important point. I mean, what Deborah's just observed, I think, is a carryover from the culture of science, where it's knowledge for knowledge's sake. But engineers are about applying knowledge to do something. And so I think it's particularly dangerous for engineers to say, well, I'm just developing technology, and how my technology is used doesn't. I think that is incredibly dangerous. Irresponsible, malpractice, use all kinds of bad words and characterizations. And so to the degree that that's in our culture, I think it's absolutely essential that we root that out.
I love this thread of conversation too. And it reminds me of, you know, you start thinking about the reductionist approach, which we have to use to focus on something. But then I've also pleasantly seen, and especially I think the Keene organization, these 50 universities and 3,500 faculty members that are working on this, are much more open to the systems engineering and thinking broadly about systems, to include socioeconomic, all of those factors in terms of the system. And so the wonderful part about engineering is it has to live at both ends. It works at the reductionist kind of micro level to work on a particular problem, calculate a force, design a circuit. But then at the macro level, because so much of our work is exportable, tradable, scalable, that you have to think at a systems level. And that that's where I think go back to some of the keynotes comments, that value proposition, she didn't say this, this is my reaction to it. Value proposition has played such a central role to the shaping of states, shaping of companies. I mean, the value proposition is a driving force, and it's not always money. Value could be termed in terms of societal good. It can be, but there is a value proposition that drives things. And we have to think in terms of a systems value proposition, as well as the down to the object that we're working on. It's an optimistic part of engineering for me that we can focus on systems, and there is a lot of growing inertia.
I appreciate that. I also sense in your responses that I think we're turning the corner. I have a lot of hope. I see a lot of young faculty who truly embrace and understand the responsibility they have to move beyond those just technical aspects of what we do and really contextualize it, as Norman has pointed out, and really frame the conversation differently. So I really am hopeful that the next generation, you know, my father always said that as parents, you want the next generation to be better than you. So that's a thing, you want the next generation of engineers to be better.
And I think the more diverse the profession becomes, the more this will happen.
Yeah, I agree. Related to those responses and that question, the next one has to do with what would you describe as the primary influences on the development of your character? So for this one, I'm gonna direct to Norman first, then Deborah, and then Doug.
Oh, gee, thanks. primary influences on the development of my character. I'm gonna have to go back to Doug's answer and talk about my parents and what they would or would not tolerate, what they expected, and how they enforced their expectations, positively and negatively from my viewpoint. Those basics of when you're growing up, whoever your family, and family is a very broad term, the people with whom you regularly interact as you are growing and learning about the world, those influences can live with you for a lifetime. I mean, last night, when Colin Powell was talking to Madeleine Albright, he was talking about his parents.
Yeah.
And how he had a picture still in his downstairs room of I think it was either Harry Truman or Theodore Roosevelt. So, I mean, you know, things that seem inconsequential, or maybe not inconsequential, but seem transitory, can have a very deep impact on a developing mind. And so that, you know, we're getting a little bit off topic here, but how we influence particularly young children, and this is why exposure to the broadest set of opportunities possible is so important. And it gets to, you know, the equity arguments about and social inequity and economic inequity. Why that's so crucial, because it sets your view of what is the realm of the possible, what is the realm of the acceptable. And so for me, you know, I grew up in a very nuclear family that moved around. My dad was in the Army. We moved every 3 years. So the consistency of the environment that my parents, my older sister built is what had the most profound influence on me.
Who's next, me or
Deborah?
Oh, I'm next, okay. Well, this is a little complicated. And I don't know exactly how much to say. Okay, so definitely, of course, family. But then I want to move to, and probably most fundamentally, family. But then there are those early years in a career, especially for a woman working in a context that was predominantly male. And so a few women models and men models too, because I had to figure out how to break certain to learn kind of a culture, a professional culture. I didn't come from a background where my parents had gone to college, you know, so I'm a first generation in that respect. So having some models, which of course, you know, then there's the question of who you select as your models, which is very much influenced by your background, because there's some people, you know, whose behavior I just automatically didn't want to model. But there were these models and people who exhibited these virtues that I had already come to, value, but who showed me how to, behave those, however you say that, in a professional context. Those were really important. And for me, it was also kind of peers. It was also because in this case, it was women, a group of young cohort women who were new to, trying to figure out how to navigate in this engineering university. So we had long conversations about, actually, just for fun, I'll just tell you, we had a group that talked about how to become, you know, men in this culture, you know, how to behave, what was male culture like. So those were really important because it was also kind of in the context of ethics. So professional models, and I had, I was really blessed with having good female models as well as good male models to do that. Sorry, that's way out there, but no, it might be helpful to somebody.
It's helpful to me, Deborah. And so I'm going to pick up on your theme with that early career. I do think that those are we have these formative times, right? There are just sometimes there's catalytic moments. There's something formative about them. I was an R&D engineer working. I shared an office, our small size company. Shared an office. We were both, desks were opposite sides of walls, and we were both the two engineers, my colleague in there were inventing, if you will, coming up with algorithms to solve a particular problem. And it was in the active sound and vibration control world. He became jealous of me and I became jealous of him. And we went almost as far as to put a line down the office. We didn't quite do it. But I tell you what, there was something that grew in that jealousy until one day our leader, the director at the time, brought us into his office and said, "You two have to stop this." And so if I answer your question, Olga, what would you describe as primary influences? I will say I believe that my fellow panelists are probably faultless and blameless, but I think some of my primary influences are learning from my mistakes. And you experience these consequences, you have somebody show you a better way. And I often think of, you know, you think about control systems, which have feedback control, and you're just thankful that there are people in your lives that provide that feedback control. And that was one particular instance where I think it was a check in character, and you learn from it and you move on. And so primary influences, I would say kind of like Deborah, it's learning. It's not always blameless learning, but it is learning. So.
But that speaks to as well in the context of education, the importance of providing faculty, TAs, et cetera, the space to provide that type of feedback that, you know, we put so much pressure on educational professionals with an S on the end, because we're talking about a variety of different professionals that shape the education of our students, that they often feel so much pressure and such a high pace that they cannot do. Okay, I've got to get these 10 things done, and they rush off. And to have somebody take the time to offer that correction in a lab, as you turn in a homework, in a hallway conversation, is crucial to professional formation.
Right, and to do it in a non-threatening way, so that it wasn't, just the kind of quiet little, you know, there's a different way to handle that.
Now that's beautiful. You've talked about specific individuals, specific sort of environments, a learning through failure, which is also kind of built into kind of who we are as engineers, and but related to how we grow as individuals. This next set of questions, so just to transition us, this next set of questions are going to move us away from thinking about just sort of those personal reflections to thinking about the profession and thinking about this profession sort of specific questions about character. So this first question, we'll start with Norman, then go to Deborah and Doug. The question is, much has been written recently about the decline in social trust. including a decline in trust in institutions. Mm-hmm. What role do you think professionals in engineering and technology should play in promoting social trust and advancing the public good?
So that's interesting, because there was an editorial in the Washington Post by someone whose name I don't remember that touched on this issue. And I think it's important to remember that even though we live in an increasingly technological society, engineering, technology, and science provide facts, but the public, particularly most recently, is reacting to, given those facts, what is the value trade-off? So for example, and I, to Doug's point, that's one of the learnings that I took from a realizing my own blindness on this. This was a blind spot for me. I said, well, the facts are clear, therefore X, Y, and Z must follow. Not necessarily. There are, what's something simple I can pick that's least controversial? Wearing a face mask in the face of COVID. It's the facts are that a mask will inhibit the spread of the particles that carry the virus. That's a fact. Now, early on, because there was a relative shortage of masks, the initial guidance from the government was, well, not everybody needs to wear a mask. What they didn't say was, because we need to prioritize them for the people who are most at risk, because that's a long message and how do you get that out to the public? Then when more masks became available, they switched up and said, everybody needs to be wearing a mask. And portions of the public said, well, wait a minute, you just switched up on me and I don't understand why. And this is inconvenient. And so it may impede the spread of particles, but as a value judgment, I don't believe that I want to wear one. And based on what you said before, I don't think I have to wear one. So there are that, or probably more to the point, if you are a small business, do I want to say I'm going to shut down and lose what I've worked my whole life to build up this business? Is there something short of that I can do? Your 20%, your 50% capacity? So the fact may be accepted. There's a pandemic. The value trade-off in what is necessary to protect the public health versus the health of my business, my child's education, if I don't have good internet access and therefore they spend a year not learning anything. Those are value questions informed by the facts, but the facts don't predetermine the outcome. And so I think maintaining awareness of that trade-off is how we build trust, by acknowledging that for some folks, they're doing a different value proposition. And if we can surface those different assessments of value, we can have a conversation about why do you value X more than Y, while I value Y more than X, rather than debating whether or not facts are facts or facts are choices instead.
So let me take a slightly different version of that. I have actually three things to say about this, and I'll say them quickly. The first thing is to say that trust really depends on expectations. And so when you have to set the expectations and then meet, and then whatever they are, if you meet them, then people trust. And if you don't meet them, so I think a lot can be done. I think that's similar to what Norman was saying. Mm-hmm. But I think when it comes to engineers, we're not, we have these mixed expectations, or I don't even know if people know what to expect, which takes me to my second point, which is that we have to make a distinction between, and this is generated in part by Shannon's talk again, I think we probably have to make a distinction between engineers and technology. Mm-hmm. And then, but when we go to technology, you know, it's a much more complicated who's responsible for technology. It's not just engineers. I think engineers may be blamed mistakenly since they're just part of the, so trust in technology is another more complicated thing. And then the third thing, just because I'm a troublemaker, is I want to suggest that there's some value to mistrust. We shouldn't discount the value of mistrust. I mean, probably the simplest example of that is when we mistrust, we often set up systems to counteract it. So if you've got, if you're worried about, we have these things about conflict of interest, we set up systems to counteract them. So mistrust can be a good thing. And I sometimes think in the case of technology, it's not, I mean, you know, it's there are degrees, but right. I just want to put that on the table.
I like that provocation, and I can see that bumper sticker. Both your points, you talk about kind of the complexity of messaging today. The complexity of messaging because of the signal to noise ratio that we have. There's so much, you have biased sources, you have hyperbole that seems to kind of dominate what is just kind of a rational message sometimes. And sometimes that comes around technology, right? You know, the saving grace, the saving capability of a particular technology or something like that, and hyperbole can come in, sensationalism, et cetera. And it's difficult in the profession, I think, now as an entire profession of engineers to kind of have what you would really like to connote, critical thinking, consistency, intellectual humility, some of the things that we've talked about, resourcefulness. All of those things are really what you want to put across. The messages aren't quite as sexy though, sometimes when you're describing, you know, here's the real facts and here's the real expectations that we have of this technology, of this particular group. I think that's just something we have to combat, and we have to, it's kind of interesting. One of my personal habits has been listening to presidential addresses that reach way back. And I don't know if you Herbert Hoover was kind of one of the famous civil engineering presidents. You know, he was he's gone down in history, you know, of course, kind of coincident with the Depression, and he purportedly didn't have enough intellectual humility to kind of see some of the challenges that were associated with that. And so that's how history records that. So how do you create a trustworthiness that has this consistency and clear message? I don't know. I think it is simply our profession celebrating some of the, you know, you have you ever heard the phrase, you become what you celebrate? And you celebrate the consistency and celebrate the engineers. And we can do that as an educational group. And I think actually there are a lot of faculty these days who are ready to raise that level of character visibility. And we'll do that through models, and we'll do that through focusing on trustworthy engineers. And we have to help kind of roll that out with an understanding that all people are fallible, but this trustworthy engineering can become sort of maybe a new moniker.
I want to return to Deborah's point about the value of mistrust. And I want to particularly focus in on artificial intelligence as it's being used. There are some new systems that are supposed to objectively look at records and decide, rather than having a judge or a jury decide on whether or not someone right. is eligible for bail or bond or release into the community. There's an algorithm that will decide based on X, Y, and Z whether or not they are safe. But the bias is built into the algorithm itself. And yeah. you mentioned before the case of the Google engineer who had looked at some of these issues of bias within algorithms. So a healthy degree of skepticism, of mistrust, of a techno fix, I think is absolutely essential, particularly given when the stakes are increasingly high. A different sort of example that's becoming increasingly prominent are the deep fakes. Yeah. Used to be you could trust what you saw with your eyes and heard with your ears, and now we know that's no longer true. Yeah. So some healthy skepticism of technology and technologies is important as well.
I appreciate that. A little bit of what I heard is, you know, maybe it's built into the engineering culture. There's an element of compliance that maybe should be, we should be teaching more of the skepticism, is thinking about how mistrust is an opportunity, right? And so when I think about the virtue that's linked to that, it's courage. And so when we think about courage and to what extent we create those spaces in educator engineers or in the environments that the engineers work, where is that rewarded? Going back to kind of the celebration piece. And so I think there's opportunities in your responses that hopefully the viewers are able to spark some ideas for them. The next question is thinking about the future. So beyond sort of the current state of engineering as a profession, in the future, what ethical issues will be most important for the professionals in engineering and technology? So Deborah, I know you have a new book out on engineering ethics. So I'm gonna ask you to address and start the response to that question and then hand it over to Doug and then Norman.
Do you mean what technologies of the future or what issues for engineers in the future?
It could be both. It could be both. It's thinking about maybe what ethical issues will be present for us in the future, but what you also think are the most important ways to sort of support professionals through it. So you can look at it from.
Yeah, I this one I'm not so well prepared for, but I'll try. I'll start off by just saying, right now, I've been reading a lot about climate change, and I think that is undoubtedly, indubitably the challenge of the future. And we are going to need engineers who we can, you know, who can think very creatively and carefully about this, but it won't just be engineers. I mean, it's really gonna be, have to take a real transformative, effort. And so, you know, it will call upon all the kind of virtues that we can imagine that engineers will need. And especially because it's a global problem, it will require all the communications capacities, and thinking about social implications will be kind of implicit in this. So I don't know, you know, it's hard for me to think about the future in terms of just engineers, because I think of engineers in this context of government and corporations, and everything is going to have to kind of move and adapt. So complicated, too complicated for me in a few minutes.
Olga, am I up next? With yes, this challenging question. There are, you know, certainly you can take this in the direction of some specific technologies. And Norman already mentioned one that is kind of bias in algorithms that are built into algorithms. But there are others that I think have been hinted at, but kind of the lack of disclosure of the use of private data. When you're, you know, that's certainly, so we can get down at that level and talk about some of these things. The lack of barriers to the financial the fintech industry, you know, that's a You can just join that and it can create those algorithms, and that engineering that can create major change. So there is a long list of specific technical areas that we have to face. But, you know, that's kind of like looking at the difficult side. There are, if you turn this, you flip the coin for a minute and look at some of the aspirational pieces, like the UN Sustainable Development Goals, those 17 goals that focus on things like, how do we, let's just get a little bit focused on particular topics that are around data or poverty or food or developing economies. Those things, that is kind of flipping that all is actually inspiring to me to think, where can you lean into some of those specific challenges, build in elements of character so that, you know, it's always hard to foresee where a particular tech, it's really difficult in a world that people say it's chaotic, that it's hard to figure out how emergent things are going to go. But if you're monitoring this with real intent of doing good for others, creating value for others, it's the only way we can navigate this. And so I like to flip the coin and say, okay, we know that there are collections of challenges, but where do we want to press in to some of these future great goals that we have as a world?
I want to pick up on points made by Deborah and Doug. So I absolutely agree with Deborah about climate change and everything related to it, and Doug's point about the UN Sustainable Development Goals. But I think those highlight, in terms of an ethical challenge, the challenge is looking long-term for the future, which is sort of important to the future of humanity, versus quality of life now. Mm-hmm. And that is an increasingly stark choice with an ethical overlay when we talk about developed versus developing nations. So there are, you know, because of climate change, we're saying we should reduce the use of coal and fossil fuels. And you've got developing countries saying, wait a minute, you guys have developed now. Now you want to tell us that we can't use these same technologies to build up our economies and help our people now because of some future threat. And the future threat's important, but we have people who need help now. And so this trade-off between the future and we live in a world, how can I politely say this, where the pressure on political leadership is to be concerned with the here and now, at least before the next election, versus the long-term sustainability of a population, I think that ethical conundrum will permeate numerous sectors of society.
I want to add just one thing to the conversation, and that is, because you mentioned my book, I think the new one of the new grounds for engineering is to address social justice. That hasn't been in the umbrella of engineering, you know, interests or responsibilities, and I think more and more we're recognizing the implication of technologies implicated in social justice. And so I think engineers are going to increasingly have to take that into account, mm-hmm. as evidenced with the AI and bias and, yep. and more and more issues, built environment.
And I think that's a great point in thinking about justice as that virtue, that how can we do that better? How can character be educated and improved among current professionals in engineering and technology? Doug, I'm going to see if you can start with that one. So I'll repeat it. I don't know if you have a question. I'm happy to repeat it. So how can we build in character and educate current professionals in engineering and technology?
Yeah, you know, there's character is a long-term development process. I mean, that's the way I see it. If you ever printed anything with a 3D printer, it can be a long-term development process. It's, I think, but there's always the starting point. And we have the opportunity, maybe now more than ever, with, and it's not just social corporate responsibility. It's not just an economics thought. There was a previous presenter earlier today who talked about kind of the economics, neoliberalism, and was concerned about that. I think it had it a little bit backwards, frankly. I think the character is really the starting point, regardless of the economics, any of these, certainly there are systems we need to think about, our systems, but the character piece is a long build. I'll be interested what my other panelists have to say about how to get started with this process, particularly with existing engineers in the educational sphere. I think we have many more answers. And I think we have the opportunity right now, there's 3,500 faculty members that are working on this entrepreneurial mindset idea. But this entrepreneurial mindset can be kind of a scary term to folks because it almost sounds like running amok, but the point is entrepreneurial mindset needs to be integrated with character to really produce good, social good, economic good, just kind of the better world that folks like Hans Rosling, that late Swedish statistician, said, look, the world is getting better and better. Here's evidence. Let's understand this. How do we continue that trend? And I do think that, wrapping this into educational activities, capstone, or any projects that an engineering graduate might encounter, this is kind of a key formative place. A job is a key formative place. This is the place to raise this topic up and make it more visible and say, this is not just a project about completing this circuit board and this technology, but it's actually a project about understanding who this is for, the compassion you have for them, the intellectual humility that promotes your curiosity. It's wrapping things around that formative space. That's where our focus is. That's where certainly I've been able to put some efforts, but even more importantly, these educators in this network have been able to put some efforts. So I'm excited about that aspect, and I think that's how we continue to press into this.
I think there's an opportunity in terms of practicing engineers, because you mentioned something about current practitioners as well. Professor Valor talked about polymaths and a need to move toward polymaths. I think there will be a business imperative, because everyone's afraid of getting sued about something. There will be a business imperative to broaden the skill sets and the perspectives that working engineers, that working professionals across the board bring to their work. Because at least for the moment, there's this increased attention to social justice, there's increased attention to equity and fairness. People who live outside of Flint care about the quality of their water, and the research has shown water quality is bad across the nation. And there are, you know, other issues as well. I think there will be increasing. So Doug mentioned corporate social responsibility earlier. I think that sort of exists in some places sort of as a thing on the side, as maybe a PR thing, as well as some people who are legitimately well-intentioned. I think that will become increasingly central, at least within the US, because of the pressure in our court system. The I'm going blank on the name, but the company that did the opioid, the settlement. Those types of cases, sorry, I'm blanking on that. Those types of cases are going to become more prominent. The settlements are going to become larger. And the pressure on companies, on for-profit companies, to protect their position by having their staffs look at things from more angles in order to protect the company, in some sense, the capitalist imperative will drive some of this, not all of it, not a lot, but some of this will come from that direction, which in a capitalist society is not insignificant.
You wanted me, I don't have much to add. I mean, I'm very impressed with what you, Olga, are doing at Wake Forest in terms of trying to embed, you don't have to introduce new courses or things, you sort of embedded in already existing courses and make it part of your objectives. I just think it will take, it's in the details sort of, not in the big transformation of curriculum.
Thank you so much for those responses. What I heard there is that, yeah, absolutely, organizations, industry, there's a responsibility there to start anywhere. As Doug pointed out, it's a development, right? You just have to have a willingness to start at any point and work your way towards sort of those very clear, achievable goals at a personal level and at a professional level. As we wrap up, I want to give you, 1 minute each to kind of maybe share something that's on your mind or connect an idea from the keynote and Shannon Valor's talk. Maybe something that has not been shared yet that has been on your mind because it's related to the conversation that we're having. And so, Doug, if you can think about that and share your sort of closing remarks in maybe the themes that even you heard. So it's open space to allow you to maybe share what's on your mind.
I will keep this brief. I appreciate the nature of this conference because, I've sat in on all the proceedings and then you think about, being the engineering background, you think about, well, how does engineering fit this? How does engineering fit that? And you really start realizing, of course, that tech and engineering is inextricably linked to all these other forces that are all the other professions that are on here. And of course, all the other forces. And I think there's a terrific message there, a terrific challenge also as a profession to, and maybe this, the call that Shannon Valor had for us is to be leaders. Maybe that's the summation of that. Among these folks, engineering plays such a, I go back to the top of the, of our time together. Engineers, as somebody told me, engineers are so consequential because of the scale and speed at which they are developing things. They're so consequential. And we have this opportunity. I think it's taking the optimist view. I think we have the opportunity to be leaders in this space and bring character more into the forefront than it's been before.
Thank you, Doug. Deborah, would you like to go next?
I have two different thoughts. I mean, one thought is that we should be reframing engineers to see them as, to understand that engineering is a social endeavor. And I mean that not just in the sense that what engineers do involves interaction with other people, but actually engineers build society. They build the social world as well as the material world by in the way they design and produce things. So that's my first thought. But of course, my second thought is they don't do it alone. And so we really, it's a chicken egg. It's not really a chicken egg. It's more the beehive problem. If you want good individuals, good engineers, individual engineers, you have to have a good hive in which they operate and function. So today we've been talking mostly about, I think virtue leads us to the virtue of individuals. And we haven't been talking about the virtue of organizations and the broader world in which those organizations work. So we need we need to think about the organizations that engineers work in, and it, you know, I think in my book I have a chapter on whether it's rotten apples or rotten barrels, you know, and so those two things kind of go, rotten apples lead to rotten barrels, rotten barrels lead to that, I mean, I think that's a really important thing to keep in mind, so.
I want to pick up on that point and return to a point that we discussed earlier in terms of the importance of the profession. In the Middle Ages, there was the guild, and your ultimate loyalty was to the guild, because that protected you irrespective of who you happened to be working for at the moment. And everything is a pendulum swing, but I think we need to encourage the ethics at the individual, yes, at level, yes, at the organizational level, yes, but also at the level of the profession and the guild, our responsibility as engineers to other engineers to be held accountable and to hold accountable in all the different ways that if we carry that title, and this is, we can get a whole separate argument about how to do that, whether it requires professional registration or whatever, but irrespective of that, the need to hold each other accountable for how we operate, I think is crucial and just something we need to do.
Thank you so much, Norman, Deborah, and Doug. I have a quote here from Aristotelis in Greek. I have to pronounce it the right way, you know, of course. There's a quote here that I want to kind of wrap things up because I think it connects to the many ideas that you all have shared. And so Aristotle said that good moral character is not something that we achieve on our own. We need a culture that supports that flourishing. And I think I've heard that theme throughout your responses to these questions. I've been really inspired today in the keynote and Shannon Valor's talk and then the conversation here. Hopefully it's the beginning of something, of many more conversations, because it takes effort. We have to start somewhere. And I know that a lot of us have, as educators, have been looking for those ways to infuse ethics and virtues and character in educating the next generation. I'm really glad that there's also professional engineers who are listening to this talk and are able to also be inspired with action, right? Conversation hopefully leads to action, individual action and collective action. And so I want to thank you again for your time, sharing your expertise and your insights. And again, grateful for this opportunity that we've had together. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Olga. And thank you, panelists. Good conversation. Yeah. Let's start that guild.